Welcome. I'm so happy you could all make it. I'm the Transplant Services Director at the National Kidney Foundation and a social worker. Today, March 8th, is World Kidney Day and the perfect time to talk about the unique role social workers play in empowering transplant recipients to be effective advocates for themselves and others. Today's call is one of many empowerment events NKF People Like Us has planned around the country. The NKF People Like Us provides advocacy training for kidney patients, and all they need to do is sign up through the National Kidney Foundation. Today's telephone conference will simulate a real-time single-topic discussion with three transplant recipients. This conference call is part of a new NKF program called Coffee House Conversations, whereby social workers meet with transplant recipients and family members to discuss specific topics of interest, such as today's topic about empowerment and advocacy. The discussion will be led by a social worker. After listening, you'll be able to introduce techniques to recipients to help them collect, understand, and manage information that can be crucial to their well-being and to effective partnership with their healthcare providers. Offer opportunities for transplant recipients to give and receive support through discussion groups, newsletters, advocacy activities, through a variety of resources, including the NKF's resources. You will also be able to encourage transplant recipients to advocate for themselves and others. We have a lot of really useful information for you. The purpose of today's discussion is to bring you insights as to how transplant recipients live well after transplant. At the National Kidney Foundation, our goal is to make lives better. We are here to bring you the information and tools you need so you can empower the recipients you work with to live the best life they can. With great pleasure, I would like to introduce today's social worker, Coffee House Conversations facilitator, Laura Tushla. Laura has been a social worker with the kidney and pancreas transplant team at Rush University Medical Center in Chicago for 8.5 years, and prior to that has worked as a dialysis social worker. Her list of accomplishments are many and too much to mention all here. Laura is a former social work editor of Transplant Chronicles, a newsletter for recipients and family members, and an active member of the Council of Nephrology Social Workers. While at Rush, she is also cross-covered for the liver transplant team and has some familiarity with this group as well.
Thank you, Kathy. I would also like to thank Wyeth for their generous support of today's program and to let you know that neither I nor any of the participants have any financial interest in Wyeth's products or services. Today's discussion will be about how social workers can help transplant recipients become and stay empowered. Through this conversation, you will hear the steps or levels of empowerment as defined by our transplant experts. Also, you will be able to identify some concrete ways that you can support your patients along their journey toward empowerment. With me are three outstanding members of the National Kidney Foundation's transplant family. They are part of the People Like Us Transaction Council, a network of over 7,000 transplant recipients of all organs. In addition to being accomplished individuals, they are also organ transplant recipients. First off, I would like to introduce Tamara Lewis, a motivational speaker and consultant from Texas who received a kidney from a living donor in June of 2002.
Thanks, Laura. I'm happy to be here.
Next, we have Jim Gleason, a recently retired IT professional from New Jersey who received a new heart in 1994. Jim has appeared on national TV and radio to support organ donation. He has won 5 U.S. Transplant Game medals and an Outstanding Contribution Award for promoting organ donor awareness from the American Society of Transplantation.
Hi, Laura. Great to be here.
And last but certainly not least, we have Rachel Wong, a kidney transplant recipient from 2002 living in Hawaii. She runs the state's hospice and palliative care organization and is a former president of the Transplant Association of Hawaii and serves on the UNO's Transplant Administrators Committee. So nice of you to join us today, Rachel.
Thanks, Laura. It's a pleasure.
We have a lot to cover today, so let's get started. Let's start with the basics. What does patient empowerment mean to all of you, and why do you think it's so important for transplant recipients?
Laura, to me, patient empowerment is very simple. It means being proactive about your health, doing everything you possibly can to stay happy and healthy.
I agree with Tamara. I think the most important aspect of empowerment is involvement. And by that I mean staying involved in what's going on around you. This can be difficult to do when you're not feeling well. As transplant recipients, we totally get that. But I think you are much more likely to feel well again if, as a patient, you are an active participant in your recovery.
That's true. It can be difficult for a transplant recipient to stay on top of his or her health, particularly if one's not feeling well. But receiving a new organ is a second chance at life. It's a wonderful gift. This is a chance to be healthy and to be back. It's important for recipients to take their lives into their own hands, to make the most of this incredible opportunity, and to be proactive and empowered.
Now, it seems like there are stages to empowerment. There are steps to take, and an order in which to take them to become empowered. What I mean is we can't expect the recipient to run out and start a support group immediately after their transplant. The first step toward empowerment, I think, is to recover from the surgery and to begin by learning about caring for the new organ.
That's definitely true. The first place with which recipients need to start is their own health. They need to learn and understand what's medically going on physically, emotionally, and spiritually. This first step can provide an extraordinary sense of empowerment, and with that, recipients can begin to feel stronger and in tune with their new self.
I totally agree. If a recipient is not feeling well, they can't be strong enough to take care of themselves, which is what empowerment means. Once they feel well for long enough, they can start to help others, which will make them feel even better.
I know that many of the transplant recipients I have worked with have come out of their operation feeling pretty weak. You have a lot of work to do to get back on track with diet and exercise. Plus, many kidney recipients have spent a long time on dialysis, during which they've had to follow very restricted diets. Many of the liver transplant recipients I've known have been getting physically weaker over a long period of time, too. Having a functioning organ returns many things to normal, and appetite is one of them. Although not every recipient takes prednisone anymore, I've been told that taking prednisone makes some people feel hungry all the time, which can make eating healthy even more difficult. How did you all get into a normal eating routine after your transplant?
Boy, did I struggle with prednisone. It felt sometimes as though it called my name to eat. Eventually, I figured it out that it was only the drug, not my body, and that it just wanted to be fed. So when I would get that call, I reminded myself that I was listening only to the drug, not my body. I also drank a lot of water, which made a big difference.
That's great, Tamara. I remember that it was also hard for me to switch to a so-called normal eating diet after I got off dialysis. My biggest challenge was not eating enough protein after years of limiting protein intake.
Weight management has also been a big issue for me over the years, that's for sure. After my transplant, I saw the hospital dietitian once and took time to prepare meals that were both healthy and appetizing. But the biggest help for me in keeping the weight off was exercise. Recently, now almost 13 years after my transplant, I developed diabetes, and that has helped me to add real discipline in my exercise and eating habits, losing 25 pounds with this renewed focus. It's amazing how such challenges can actually be a blessing in one's life if you deal with them in a positive, empowered way.
So let's talk about exercise, since it is a big part of recovery and feeling empowered after transplant. Many people go into the transplant surgery severely debilitated. How did all of you get your muscles going after the surgery? What tips can you share with other recipients to help get back on track?
Well, Lara, the secret for me has been walking, a lot of walking. Once I felt strong enough, I started walking every day, and I was able to keep off the 60 pounds I lost in the hospital. Of course, when I returned to work 2 years later, I no longer had time, or rather, I no longer made time to exercise, so my weight slowly crept up, and it's still a struggle for me. But I know that regular exercise is the way to keep it under control.
I'm a huge fan of walking. When I first started getting back into exercise, I pushed myself to walk at least 4 miles around the track 3 times per week. This made a difference in my attitude towards my mind and body. I felt that I had some control.
You know, walking is also a great way to work towards something. For instance, after a transplant, when people feel well enough, they can travel. Walking is a good way to get ready for visiting new places and exploring new cities. And with walking, recipients can take it as slowly or quickly as they want, and watching themselves getting stronger and into better shape, that can be very encouraging. The year after my transplant, I joined a gym. I'd never even been inside one before. It was really intimidating at first, watching all these confident and toned people working out, but I just kept going back, and now I'm in the gym or on the tennis court 5 to 6 days a week. It certainly helped to work with a trainer to learn how to use the machines and to create my own workout. And the gym work, yoga, and racket sports have resulted in my bone density health. My bones have actually gone from osteoporotic to normal density, from weight-bearing exercise, diet, and without any drugs. And I'm a big advocate of yoga because it's not just physical. It can also address the emotional and spiritual part of health. Many types of yoga are safe for people of all ages and in any state of health. During the years I was not well, I did relaxing, restorative poses with breathing. Yoga is great because you're not measuring yourself against anyone else, and it's all about listening to your body. I found that I am strong, flexible, and balanced in this practice, other sports, and my life because of yoga.
So one of the things social workers can do is to encourage recipients to find physical activities that they enjoy, and for some people to connect with a dietitian to learn more about the best way to feed their new organ. I know many recipients are anxious about exercising, but generally, any exercise a recipient chooses to do should work on their strength, flexibility, and endurance. Walking is great for that, but if you know it's not for you, we encourage people to think about activities they've enjoyed in the past. Swimming, bicycling, skiing, aerobics. There are too many options to be bored by exercise. Recipients should check with their doctor or nurse before starting any new physical activity program. So what else is important to emphasize about getting back on track health-wise besides diet and exercise?
You know, I think it's very important to build a strong transplant team made up of people whom you trust and who trust you.
I'd agree with that. I have a wonderful doctor who I work really well with. I think that's been essential to my journey.
I think you're absolutely right. Finding a good doctor, a good social worker, a good nurse, people who openly listen to me as part of that team is really important. For a transplant to succeed, all members of the team have to meet their responsibilities, plain and simple.
Well, and don't forget yourself. The most important member of the transplant team, without question, is you, the transplant recipient. Sure, you may have less medical training and expertise, but you know when something isn't right with your body. I read in a report titled A Portrait of the Chronically Ill in America, they reported about 50% of chronically ill people feel that their doctor offers them choices, discusses pros and cons, takes their preferences into account, and asks patients for their treatment preferences on a consistent basis. Recipients have the most invested in their success. Of everyone involved, they want this organ to work better and longer than anyone else. So, Jim, how involved in your healthcare decisions are you?
I consider myself to be the most active member of my transplant team. I'm the only one on call 24 hours, 7 days a week, and I care more than any other team member about whether my transplant succeeds.
Why do you think it's so important for you to be your team's leader?
Well, unfortunately, even in a perfect system, mistakes can happen. I know because they've happened to me. A doctor once by mistake added a zero to one of my doses, a simple mistake that I caught when they came in to give me that med and had to fight to get them to accept that he had copied the number down wrong when he wrote it down from my own printout of meds that I carry with me at all times. Another time, a doctor forgot to mark in my chart. I'd already received a dose of my medication. But in both cases, I protected myself because I kept track of what I received and how much. Now, I don't take any medicine without first talking to a doctor about it, what it's for, why I need to take it. So if my team makes a decision before asking me, I won't go along with it until they bring me into the process and explain why it's important.
Do some members of your healthcare team find that frustrating?
Well, that's just tough. There have been times when I refused a medicine because I didn't know what it was. A doctor had come by later to take extra time to speak to me about it before I agreed to take it. Yeah, that adds time to their busy day, but let's remember what's important here. I'm only asking for a few extra minutes from them, and by doing so, I'm keeping myself safe, which saves them work in the long run, don't you think? If I had a doctor who had a big problem with this, I would find another doctor. Now, understand, I don't mean to be negative about the healthcare system. There are wonderful doctors and hospitals and nurses and social workers. Like I said, I love my team. But even in the best of circumstances, mistakes can happen. And if you're alert, empowered, and involved, you'll protect both them and yourself from that.
And even if I trust my doctors completely, I make the final decisions related to my own health care. Without question, I have the most invested in it. Doesn't it make sense that I should be involved with every aspect of my medical care?
Absolutely. How do you feel about your team, Rachel?
Well, right now I work really well with my medical team, but over the years I've switched practitioners because we just weren't compatible. I utilize integrative medicine therapies, which I also know helps me. For instance, I see a naturopath and a chiropractor, and I'm involved in the healing arts community in Hawaii. My team has a few extra members.
I agree that it's very important to find a team you can best work with that serves your needs well. Like Jim said, I am my team's leader. My team is my crew, but I am the captain of this ship. But some advice. You may have to compromise a little bit. I don't believe we can find the perfect doctor or the perfect nurse or social worker, but we can find people who help us most medically. Maybe they don't have the perfect bedside manners, but they do deliver the best information, diagnosis, and help. It's like anything in life. Nothing's perfect, but you stick with what works for you.
That's a good point, Tamara. None of us are suggesting you bounce around from doctor to doctor looking for the ideal practitioner. They don't exist. But I really can't stress enough how important it is to find someone who works for you, who respects you, listens and takes you seriously, and treats you like a member of your own team. I mean, pretend that you have a symptom of something. If you don't like your doctor, you may be less likely to call and report that symptom. And if that symptom is the first warning sign of something serious, you're putting yourself in danger by avoiding that call. If I call about something, my team knows I'm calling for a good reason, and that makes me feel very cared for and empowered.
It's a great point, Jim. It reminds me of how grateful I am to have such an understanding physician. I feel like he really does listen to me, and he takes time to answer any questions I have.
I believe the best place to start is the day-to-day interactions with your transplant team. When you meet with your doctors, your nurses, your social worker, listen to what they have to say. Have them to ask questions. Have them to make sure that you really understand what they're being told. Be 100% sure that you've got it all. And that's what you want to make sure that they understand. I always say that transplant recipients have all the medical information they need right at their fingertips. I do not mean that we should run out to the library or get the internet and read everything that we can find about transplantation. That'll take years. But there's so much out there, and too much information can be a bad thing in its own way. Instead, keep your eyes out for pamphlets at the doctor's offices. Take one, bring it home, read it, and make sure you understand everything that's in it. Call up on the National Kidney Foundation and ask for patient material about transplantation.
And this is critical. Always ask questions of your team. Whenever anything happens, I want a full explanation, and I listen hard. I often ask my team members to repeat themselves just to make sure I've understood everything correctly. It only takes them a few extra moments. It saves my life, and it may do the same for others.
Clearly understanding the plan is important for every member of the team, especially you, the transplant recipient. Being an informed member of the team is another step toward empowerment. This is really interesting. A recipient, Marge, wrote a letter to the National Kidney Foundation and explained that the better her relationship with her team, the easier it was to ask questions. Marge used the following technique to get her questions answered without being too pushy. I put things in the personal by saying, "This is very frightening for me. Could you please explain in detail what will happen?" I'm sure that helped to remind the other members of the team to slow down and take the needed time to make sure Marge was comfortable with the information. It's hard to stay involved when you or someone you love feel anxious or not well physically, but it is very important. Marge wrote that being her own advocate made her feel more empowered. There are times when recipients need support when they are advocating for themselves or asking a lot of questions, and this is a place where social workers can get involved.
That makes a lot of sense.
I agree that we shouldn't overload ourselves with information about transplantation, but a little can go a long way. Recipients can experience so many side effects of medication. It can be extremely uncomfortable. And if a person is uncomfortable or suffering, I suggest to them that they do a little research, ask questions, and not be afraid to let their healthcare providers know the depth of their distress. Some recipients I know try to impress their doctors, not let them know really how bad they feel, because they want their approval and want them to know they are grateful. If the doctor doesn't know, they can't help by switching drugs, changing dosages, or looking for the cause. I know some recipients tell their social workers about the distress but clam up with their doctors. Social workers are in a unique position to encourage recipients to talk to their doctors, to let them know it's okay. I appreciate when social workers share reliable websites and other resources. I also find doctors, nurses, and social workers appreciate informed consumers. Sometimes we, the recipients, can find something the healthcare team didn't think of. Just a little extra effort can make a recipient feel a whole lot better.
Here's another example where asking questions along the way made a big difference. NKF received a letter from Anne, a kidney donor for her son, Matt. Anne writes that her son's urologist of 6 years was suddenly let go, and they were faced with a new doctor who wanted to change Matt's treatment in a way that Anne didn't agree with. She says that if she hadn't asked a lot of questions along the way of Matt's previous doctor, she wouldn't know about the other options. She writes, "I feel things could fall through the cracks if questions aren't asked of everyone, and if patients should question everything that a physician says to them about future care." What are some other ways that recipients can stay involved in their medical care?
Well, one of the important things that I do for myself is to keep track of my lab values and to keep copies of all my medical reports. I've created a spreadsheet using the computer program Excel, and it tracks my lab values since 1990. I now use a computerized personal health record service, too. In a couple of seconds, I can see where things have gone up and down, and it helps me visualize my progress. If people don't have a computer or use Excel or a personal health record service, just a notebook and a pencil will serve the same purpose.
But there's so much to blood work. How do we know which values we should keep track of and what they mean?
Ask your doctor or a nurse or a social worker. Anyone who has a few minutes to spare can sit down with a recipient and discuss which values are most important, what's a normal range, and what changes are a sign you should be concerned. Personally, I now track 8 different factors. In the local ER, I met with a new doctor who took blood work and saw I had elevated levels of uric acid. Since he was new to my history and in a different hospital, he didn't have a record of my previous blood tests. He thought I had symptoms of gout, but before he could do anything, I checked back with my own records and saw my uric acid was always high. I didn't have gout. If I didn't and hadn't kept track of my blood work, I could have been very painfully treated for something I didn't have. This can be an issue anytime you see a new doctor. Maybe you're on vacation or you have to visit the emergency room. If you have your blood work history on hand, you can avoid a similar problem. And when you start tracking your blood work, ask for the actual numbers. Sometimes healthcare workers will just tell you if something's fine or high. So keep your chart up to date. You need actual numbers. And if you don't get them, ask.
These are all great suggestions, which don't really take a lot of time. Social workers and other members of the healthcare team often have resources like daily logs that can help a recipient get started with this. What are some other ways recipients can stay involved in their health?
Whenever I have questions for my healthcare team, I write them down and bring them to my appointments. I also often bring someone with me when I have an appointment. If we both listen and take notes, we can check back with each other afterwards and make sure we both got the same message. You can also tape conversation with your doctor if he or she agrees.
I've had a personal experience with being taped. I was meeting a woman during her admission for her kidney transplant. And one of the first days after her surgery, she stopped me in the middle of my introduction about myself so she could start her tape recorder and get out her pad of paper. I'd never had anybody want to tape me, and I wasn't really sure why, and it made me a little nervous. She explained that she had a lot of family members who asked her a lot of questions about everything that happened during the day. She was still a little groggy after surgery, and so she could listen to the tapes later to review what the various doctors, nurses, and I had said. Also, her family members could listen for themselves if they wanted. It made a lot of sense. It really helped her, and I think it could be useful for others. It ended up saving a lot of time, not having to repeat the same messages for different family members.
Personally, I think one of the easiest and most important ways to stay empowered as transplant recipients is to always fully understand and follow the advice of our transplant team.
You are so right. I think that's been one of the most important decisions I've made as a transplant recipient, and I truly believe it saved my life. When my doctors recommended I take steps to reduce my blood pressure, I listened. When my dietitian explained which foods were okay for me to eat and how to prepare healthy and tasty meals, I listened. And it was the same with my social worker. I always listened to every member of my transplant team.
That's a great point, Tamara, and I think it builds on your earlier message about having a healthcare team that you trust and feel you can work well with. Once you've picked your team, it's a lot easier to take their advice. But I think I speak for many transplant recipients when I say that keeping up with your health can get frustrating. It's time and energy when you're trying to get back to as normal a life as possible. Frankly, being involved isn't easy. It's like a job.
I won't disagree with you there. Like I said, having a transplant is work. It's been harder than raising my two boys. I actually think of my transplant as a new baby. When you first bring a new baby home from the hospital, you don't understand him at all. It's scary and confusing and frustrating. You want to love on him, but first you've got to understand him. But if you dedicate time to the baby, you will understand him. You figure out when he wants to eat and sleep and how to make him happy. This, in a way, describes what eventually happens if you take the time to get to know your own body inside and out. You're always carrying around something new inside of you. Once you get to know it, it will feel a lot less scary, confusing, and frustrating.
Tamara's really right about this. Having a transplant is a lot of work. Being empowered with your health takes work. But we wouldn't be advocating it if we all didn't truly believe that it's worth it in the end, that doing this work now saves you from a lot of extra work later that comes from getting sick more often and feeling worse.
Okay, well, let's say we've got the physical side of transplant down, at least for the most part. You focused on improving your health as much as possible through education, diet, and exercise. You've identified your team and developed a relationship. What's the next step to being empowered?
I think that once you're feeling better physically, you can start to concentrate on your personal life. It's hard to feel empowered and advocate for others in the transplant community if you're having trouble at home, at work, or in your other relationships.
Well, let's call this second stage of empowerment taking care of your personal life outside of your physical health. That could mean your relationships, your mental health, or anything else that makes you feel whole again, like getting back to work.
I think working was a big step in my recovery. I went back to work 4 months after my heart transplant. I loved my job, and I was eager to get back to it once I felt well enough. It went really smoothly, partly because I had engaged my colleagues in the whole transplant event by giving them regular updates. As a result, I expanded my support network and taught people about transplant recovery. None of my coworkers had known anything about heart transplant before, so they didn't know how much was possible after transplant. The day I came back to the office, my colleagues cheered. That felt amazing.
How about you, Rachel and Tamara? How did you both handle getting back to work after transplant?
Well, I took a year off to luxuriate and enjoy being well. I took dance classes, learned sign language, anything. When I felt up for it, I started volunteering to ease myself back into a regular schedule. And when I was ready to start working again, I learned that unfortunate truth, that the hardest time to find a job is when you're not working. It's another bitter irony in life, like needing to make many doctor's appointments and schedule procedures when you're the sickest and feeling not up to the task. When I started volunteering, people in my field knew that I was back, and things started flowing from there. I've been back working in the end-of-life care field since then, and it's part of reclaiming my place in the normal and healthy world.
Before I got sick, I was a motivational speaker for my own company. Being my own boss, I was able to continue working as a motivational speaker, making in, of course, my own hours. And as I got to know my way around the nephrology community, I was able to tailor some of my key seminars for them and develop some new clientele. So from a work perspective, this journey has been a blessing. Who would have ever thought that you could say what you can say about the transplant community? Now, I love talking about dialysis and the transplant process. My mission is to motivate and encourage people in the business, in life and transplantation. I want to be able to inspire people in all life situations not to give up.
For people who haven't worked in some time or need additional training to return to the workforce, I often talk about things like vocational rehabilitation options. I would encourage a big part of this second stage of empowerment, or taking care of your personal life outside of your physical health, also involves getting a handle on medical bills and insurance. Would you all agree?
Yes, that's very important. Many of us use Medicare, but the kidney transplant recipient that coverage runs out after 36 months. I did have time to do some research to assure that I would have adequate insurance. I was encouraged, and I would like to encourage transplant recipients to stay calm and tackle their financial and insurance issues step by step with the help of their social workers, as I did. After my transplant, I contacted my transplant social worker, and she told me about my choices for insurance. One company in my state, which is the state of Texas, offers a high risk pool. I looked around, and no other company would insure me, so I signed up with that.
I've been very lucky to have good medical coverage through my wife's company.
My company covers my premiums under my husband's plan.
Although I didn't learn about health insurance in graduate school, and prescription benefits are not a hot topic, one of the first things we learn in our social work training is to start where the client is. A large percentage of the conversations I have with transplant recipients start out related to finances in one way or the other. It's a wonderful gift to have a new organ, but if a person doesn't know how they will take care of it, the stress can be overwhelming. As Tamara indicated, as a social worker, I regularly talk with insurance options, however limited, ways to optimize prescription coverage, impact of work on various governmental benefits, and ways to deal with household expenses that have been building up as the medical bills stream in. Social workers and financial coordinators work with people to maximize this part of their health as well as the others. But insurance and financials are a whole nother talk, so let's get back to empowerment. I think some recipients use this second stage of empowerment to focus on mental health after transplant. I imagine it can be a big change to go from wondering if you'll get your new organ in time, to recovering from the surgery, to being a transplant recipient with a whole different future. It may seem strange to separate mental and physical health into two stages of empowerment because they're so intertwined, but let's talk about them separately here just for the purposes of this discussion. Jim, do you have any tips that you share with other recipients about taking care of this part of their health?
Sure. Being positive and taking care of our own emotional health is essential to our success as a transplant recipient. I find my attitude will dictate everyone else's. If I am positive, the people around me believe the transplant works, and they do believe it. And then they shower me with positive energy, which makes me feel even better. For instance, if a recipient decides to go back to work, he or she may have a tough time if others see the transplant as a liability. Employers start worrying the recipient will rack up too many medical expenses on the company's dollar or have to take extra time off due to illness. When you think of the average worker, don't they too have medical emergencies that they have to take time off to deal with? After our initial recovery, that isn't such a unique liability that so many seem to be concerned with. Rather, it's part of the normal human condition, especially as we get older in that work environment. But instead, should an employer focus on what a transplant recipient has accomplished? Recipients have been to hell and back. We have proven to the world that we can overcome tremendous obstacles and emerge strong and healthy. Wouldn't you want to hire somebody like that?
I would.
But outside depression, one wonderful way that I've learned to stay positive is through the influence of a wonderful supportive network. I have what I call a group of spiritual buddies. These are members of my church and friends who attend other churches. We all have struggled in different points in our lives, as everybody does. My buddies inspire me by sharing what they have overcome, how they have handled their own challenges. We just expose the good, the bad, and the ugly to each other. And when I was going through my kidney transplant, the strength of my buddies, oh, my goodness, and the examples they gave me of how to overcome adversity gave me so much confidence. They made me feel that even through their own struggles, I can be an overcomer. And I did, and now I'm an example.
Yes, support groups are great and very empowering. The National Kidney Foundation has rebranded support groups, referring to them as coffee house conversations. The intent of this is to use a word that conjures up visions of transplant recipients being in charge, in control, helping each other and themselves in discussion groups, big or small, just like we're doing right now. When I led the local transaction council, sometimes the meetings were quite large and sometimes small, and both were very useful. But it's very important to use your support group in the way that works for you. When I was undergoing my transplant experience, my community of friends and family was very interested in knowing what was happening all the time. Rather than exhaust myself by keeping up with everyone, I wrote group emails which chronicled my days. Now there are free blogs, websites. I also recorded outgoing messages on my voicemail asking well-wishers to leave positive messages and warning them I wouldn't call back unless I felt well. And then I would play the messages and hear their cheerful voices and messages back on it. This way, I received their support when I needed it, and it was on my own timing, and I didn't feel pressure to check in with people until I felt better.
The social workers who are listening to our conversation have access to screening tools like the Beck Depression Scale and others that help determine whether a person has the blues or is clinically depressed and can help direct people to available resources. Rachel and Tamara were talking about the support system, and as important as it is, finding a support system is easier said than done if you don't already have one.
That's true, but you can find support in surprising places if you're simply open to it. After my transplant, I was diagnosed with prostate cancer. I had to undergo 42 radiation treatments. Every time I went to receive another treatment, the same cancer patients were in the waiting room, there for the same reason I was. Over time, we got to know each other and became a wonderful source of mutual support. We would kid around. It got so I would actually look forward to my treatments, if you could believe it. Just knowing I could spend time with these wonderful people made the experience much more bearable. And if they could show up for treatments and have a positive attitude, so could I.
Oh, I had a very similar situation myself. I have to tell you, before my kidney transplant, I had to go through dialysis. And as luck would have it, I found a friend who was also undergoing dialysis at the same time. We had first met 10 years ago, but reconnected when we realized that we were both on dialysis. For me, it really helped to know someone who understood exactly what I was going through, like Jim found with other people dealing with cancer. We would talk to each other, support each other when one was not feeling well, and we thought we couldn't get through the day without each other. And in the end, we both received kidneys from our brothers, and we were thriving today. Because of this, I would recommend that everyone find a transplant buddy, someone who you really enjoy and respect, who is going through a similar situation. They can help you feel very understood and take away the loneliness and isolation that oftentimes you feel, and that's feeling bad physically.
Tamara, social networks or support systems have been related to reduced risk of death and a reduction in adverse health outcomes in the elderly. And over the last 20 years, there have been 13 large studies in the U.S., Scandinavia, and Japan that have shown that people who are isolated or disconnected from others are at an increased risk of dying prematurely from a variety of conditions. Rachel, where do you draw your support and strength from?
Well, in addition to family, friends, and spiritual practice, I've found that other transplant recipients, and even strangers, can be a significant source of inspiration.
What do you mean by that, Rachel?
Well, one reason I'm here today is that I was inspired by another person who had also received a transplant. Before I got my kidney, I was also on dialysis, and not that excited to undergo a transplant. I figured I was coping well on dialysis, so why change anything? I'm sure many of the social workers can relate to many people like that. After 2 years on the waiting list, I got a call from the transplant center. They had a kidney for me, and I had 1 hour to decide if I wanted it, and I didn't know what to do. At that moment, I remembered a woman I had met recently who had undergone a transplant 10 years before. I had been traveling, and we met at a dialysis center 2,500 miles from my home. She was back on dialysis because her transplant had failed. When I learned that she had already had a transplant, I asked her what the point of it was since it didn't last. And she told me that having her transplant was the best thing that had ever happened to her. She said that it gave her 10 years of health, and she would do it all over again in a heartbeat, even knowing that it wouldn't last. For 10 years, she was well. And when I had to decide if I wanted a transplant, I remembered this woman and how positive she was. Through her example, I saw that life can be better when you're off dialysis, and it's worth it to try, even if it doesn't last. I called the transplant center and told them I wanted the operation, and I'm really glad that I did. My life is so much better after my transplant, and I realized that I was physically incapable of visualizing how healthy and normal I could become. And I'm so grateful to that woman, name unknown, who inspired me to go through this.
You hear people talk a lot about giving back, about how much that helps other recipients. But I also imagine that if you give back, it can help you by giving you a sense of empowerment. For instance, Rachel, I bet it would help that woman to know that she inspires such an amazing future transplant recipient.
That's an excellent point, Lara. What she did was she showed me how important it is to give back to others as well. We're helping others and really helping ourselves.
This brings us to what I believe is the third stage of empowerment, giving back to the transplant community. Once recipients are feeling well physically and mentally, and their personal lives are getting back on track, the next stage of empowerment for many people involves helping others, which, as we've seen through these stories, is extremely empowering. I can only imagine how good it feels to know that you are helping the transplant community and to say thank you to the world for your transplant. There are so many ways transplant recipients can give back. Recipients can be mentors for someone who's on the waiting list, the way Rachel's friend was. They can participate in a support group or start a support group for recipients. And they can get involved in an advocacy network, which works to change public policy in ways that help transplant recipients. The NKF received a wonderful letter from Bob in Michigan. He says he's a peer mentor for kidney patients. He helps them cope with their present situation and look to the future when they will feel better. It's my way of saying thanks to all those people who helped me along my path, past and present, he writes. How satisfying, and what a wonderful way to honor his donor, don't you think?
I agree. I think it really helps transplant recipients to give back to others. For instance, when we're feeling good, we're great examples of what life can be after transplant. And it feels great to be an example, doesn't it, Tamara?
Yes, it does. I love telling people I am a kidney transplant recipient. Sometimes it feels like it's part of my name. Hi, I'm a kidney transplant recipient. It's often the first thing I tell people because I'm just so proud. I'm so proud to say that I am on my way to becoming a person who's had her transplant for 30 years.
Me too.
Everybody needs hope, needs something to look up to. That's us people. We are the victors, the survivors. We have been in the trenches, in the pits of hell, and we made it. We need to be proud of who we are and what we've been able to accomplish, and to share the fact with other people who need transplants. It helps them to know what their future can bring, and it brings us by reminding us of what we've accomplished. I believe that giving back is essential to our survival as transplant recipients. Truly, I believe that.
I would like to talk a little bit more about being an advocate because I think that's really important. We've talked about recipients advocating for themselves with other members of the healthcare team, but I'd like to talk a little about advocating for the larger transplant community.
Thanks, Laura. I think it's important to recognize that patient empowerment can take the form of speaking up and speaking with those who make the laws that affect us all. I've helped our Coalition on Donation pass a bill in Hawaii providing paid leave for living donors. I began this 3 years ago, and it was a whole new experience for me, writing letters to legislators, scheduling appointments, and meeting with elected officials and testifying in committees. It was so rewarding to see our bill pass the legislature, and I've enjoyed meeting with lawmakers and presenting a personal side, meaning a real face, to donation and transplantation. I know my voice was heard because I'm back at the legislature every session now for hospice and palliative care, and I'm still remembered as someone who received a kidney transplant. And in 2005, I was part of the kickoff for the National Kidney Foundation's People Like Us initiative. When I knew I was going to be in D.C., I scheduled appointments with my state's congressional delegates. That was also rewarding, and I enjoyed meeting people, sharing my story, and educating them about the importance of legislation to increase donation and improve the transplant experience for donors and recipients. By getting involved in the legislative process, I'm not only working to help others, but I'm also helping myself. I'm giving myself and others a voice.
But it's not for everybody. Let's not forget that. I've met transplant recipients who didn't thrive when they were around other recipients or got no benefit from being advocates for others. For those people, being away from the transplant community takes their mind off their situation and makes them feel, quote-unquote, normal. If that's what works best for you, honor that, too. You don't need to feel like you have to change the world by being active in the transplant community if it's hurting you. There are other recipients who benefit from giving back. You need to honor what's right for you.
That's right. But for me, it helped for a time to be involved, and then there was a time when I needed to step back and focus on things. A few years ago, I was president of the local NKF Transaction Council, the Transplant Association of Hawaii, and was involved with the Hawaii Coalition on Donation. But now I've stepped back to focus on my work and family. And at the same time, I know that I'm ultimately, because I'm working in palliative care and advanced care planning, I'm ultimately contributing to organ and tissue donation.
The three of us are members of the National Kidney Foundation's Transaction Council, a group of 7,000 heart, lung, liver recipients, social workers, and other professionals. The NKF relies on the transplant recipient members to give opinions and participate in developing programs to help others along the transplant journey. Social workers can encourage patients to join to give them a sense of belonging to a larger community. The website, www.transplantrecipients.org, which as an IT professional, I was called on to help plan and provide input for its design, has an active message board for recipients. I also volunteer at my local organ procurement organization, the Gift of Life Donor Program in Philadelphia, and a board member for the Transplant Recipients International Organization's national office. And yet, another very special way, I've become involved with UNOS, the organization that coordinates organ donation and sets policy for allocating those organs to patients in the most need. For 3 years now, I've served on their Thoracic Transplantation Committee and its Heart Allocation Subcommittee, helping medical professionals make those important life-saving decisions that affect us all, adding my unique perspective of actually having received a heart transplant to all those surgeons who only perform transplants. This month, I'm waiting to hear if my nomination to the UNOS Board of Directors may result in election to that important group, and I've just heard that I got passed over, somebody else stronger got elected that position. But talk about empowerment, progressing from patient to decision maker, something that any recipient can do by visiting the UNOS.org website and getting involved in any of their committee work that covers all aspects of the donation and transplantation process. I can tell you it's exciting to be able to share the energy of my new heart and help others in this way. UNOS openly solicits public comment on everything they do, so patients can check it out and help make a difference with their own unique life experience.
That's right, Jim. I've enjoyed being a part of one of the UNOS committees. There's a lot of organizations and events around where recipients can become involved. Help your patients to look around to see what's out there in their local communities. Ask them to take the time to find out what parts of the transplant community they want to be involved in. Some groups focus on increasing organ donation by raising awareness about organ and tissue donation. Some focus on support for recipients or donor families, and others focus on legislative initiatives.
These are all wonderful suggestions for how to give back to the transplant community. We've heard a lot of inspiring stories from transplant recipients who've gotten involved. For instance, Theodore Montana wrote the NKF to say he's a member of the Governor's Council on Organ and Tissue Donor Awareness in Montana, and they hold a yearly picnic for donors, recipients, and the general public, and every year they welcome at least 1 to 200 people. Theodore says he also helps support a walk every year to promote donor awareness. The National Kidney Foundation's local offices around the country have walks and other activities that recipients can be involved in.
That all sounds great.
Well, one final question is, did you write letters to your donor family, and how did that process work out? How did it make you feel to acknowledge your donor?
My baby brother will always be in my heart for giving me his kidney. I took care of him when he was a young lad. Now he's taking care of me.
Thank you for asking, Lara. I received my gift from a deceased donor. And for me, it's been healing to contact my donor family. I called my local OPO, the Organ Recovery Organization, the day after my surgery to find out how to write a letter to my donor family.
I've not heard back from them, but the OPO family liaison has been in touch with them. I continue to write my donor family and update them on my and my family's lives. I think this is important because they are, by virtue of our life connection, part of my life and my family too. A kidney recipient friend of mine once told me that he gave a talk for donor families and said that he was thinking about stopping sending letters to his donor family since he had done it for many years and had never heard back. After his talk, the donor family approached him and said, "Please keep writing. When my son's recipient wrote letters, for years I couldn't read them and I put them in a box in the closet. I've only recently been able to open and read the letters and am so appreciative. Please do keep writing." And so, I will continue to write letters of gratitude and news, even if I don't hear anything.
I regularly write to my donor family every year, and I advocate and help others to do the same. I really enjoy, partly because I am naturally outgoing, and have had the fortune to meet many donor families and work with them as a volunteer for our local organ procurement organization, the Gift of Life program here in Philadelphia. At the U.S. Transplant Games in 2002, I actually got to meet my donor family and heard the story of my heart donor. Another very empowering experience that is not possible for everyone, but can be a real blessing if it happens. Connecting with your donor family can be very healing and empowering.
As we draw to an end of our discussion, I think it makes sense to let the experts summarize the highlights and speak for themselves. Jim, do you have any parting words for our audience of social workers?
Sure, Lara. Happy to oblige. As patients, we have many people to help us deal with the daily challenges we must face. As social workers, you can encourage the recipients you counsel to be open to that support, but at the same time, to whatever degree an individual's illness allows, to stay responsible for one's own life. That includes not just the black and white, live or die part, but for taking responsibility for the quality of our life part that is a recipient's daily opportunity. Social workers can encourage us to stay optimistic but realistic. You can do reality checks with us to make sure our expectations are realistic and our actions sensible. Tell recipients that we should be comfortable about being honest with our transplant healthcare team members about how we are feeling and expect the best outcome, even when things look bleak. You can encourage us to share that outlook with our healthcare supporters in every way possible. How we present ourselves, how we are perceived, can play a key part in us being heard. The professionals will take their lead from our example, and that in turn will get the recipient the professional's best effort on our own behalf. I often say to those who ask about my heart, when I got up this morning, I looked down and said, "Damn, another above ground, another day. This is going to be a good one." And you know what? It always is. I hope and pray that the recipients that you as social workers work with can say the same every day of their lives. Let your recipients know they're empowered by their own attitude and that no matter what their situation or environment, they themselves have the opportunity and power of a choice every day. What is their choice today?
Thank you, Jim. And Tamara, your thoughts?
Your patients have been on an incredible journey of receiving life again. While they are traveling on this journey, you want them to know that they can be as whole as possible. Encourage them to be kind to themselves as well as others. Let them know that they can wear an attitude of gratitude. Be kind to yourself, and you will be kind to others. As you continue through this experience, take time to say thank you to those who have helped you to get this far. Renew your mind, your spirit, and boy, you will be renewing your body every chance that you can get. Take the time to smile and laugh, for this will heal your soul. Empower them with every tool you can of life so that they can take care of themselves. Share resources liberally. I also would like to recommend that people take the instead of approach. Instead of going against the wind, be like the trees and dance with the wind. Be proactive in your plight of dealing with your illness. Listen and learn everything that you can. Instead of going against the storm, act like the eagle and meet it head on. Take it on, baby. Say yes to I will do whatever it takes to stay on this planet. Say yes to doing whatever it takes for your body to be in compliance. Remember, although we may be able to give a second chance at the replacement of this organ, we cannot get another you. You are it. Let the earth smile and rejoice in your being here.
That's wonderful, Tamara. Rachel, how about you?
Well, I believe that social workers do play an important role in patient empowerment. Empowerment is a choice everyone can make. It's a personal choice whether or not to take an active role in one's own health and life. It's about moving forward and moving in a positive direction. During this talk, we've discussed many forms of empowerment, and it's up to each individual to find the right combination that works. They should do things that are filling and affirming, that allow them to be of service to others, and also to remember to ask for help when you need it. I wish everyone good luck, and do contact the National Kidney Foundation for more information. And as we say in Hawaii, aloha a hui ho. Translated, that means goodbye and until we meet again.
And on that note, I think we've covered just about everything. Now we'll take questions from the audience.
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please press star, then one. You will be prompted to record your name. To withdraw your request, you may press star, then two. Once again, to ask a question, please press star one. One moment, please. Your first question is from Francine Fern.
Hi. I'm a social worker with DaVita Dialysis in Bonita Springs in Florida, and I've just relocated and started as a social worker in this field. I've been a social worker for a number of years. The description of my job tells me to explain treatment options to patients. And before I started work here a few weeks ago, I looked up online and found all these different medical explanations of the treatment options. And I just wanted to thank the panelists today because, to me, this was a fabulous education for me to help patients understand what we're talking about in terms of treatment options for what transplant recipients need. So this was much better than any of the medical things. This gave me a lot of great ideas, and I just wanted to say thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Another point that I think this panel made, this is Catherine talking, is that social workers often lead groups. And sometimes two or three or four people will come. But even with a small number like that, it can be very valuable. And if those three or four people then go out and touch another three or four people each, it spreads. So even a small group can have a tremendous value. That's what we're hoping the panel here showed today.
We do have another question. Mari Teitelman.
Hi, this is Mari Teitelman, and I'm a licensed clinical social worker, and I'm also a transplant recipient, slightly under 3 years, kidney.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And my professional work is not in the transplant field, but as a professional and as a recipient, one, I wanted to thank all of you. It just is so delightful to hear other success stories and your knowledge and experience that you've gained over the years, and how we can all use that to help other recipients and the public understand the importance of organ donation and what happens during the process. And my question related to any experience you've had in helping recipients help others understand that once the transplant has happened, the whole process isn't like done and over and people are healthy with nothing to ever think about and worry about. Because I find in a lot of my conversations with people who have less knowledge and who haven't gone through the process that's the reaction. Well, you got your kidney, so everything's fine now, right? So I'd appreciate any thoughts you have on that.
This is Lara. I would like to second the comment about transplant is not a cure. Not everything is roses afterwards. It certainly is a lot easier to manage handfuls of medication twice a day than it is dialysis in a lot of respects, but it doesn't solve everything. Like many of the social workers in dialysis units can attest, doing support groups in the transplant center is not particularly easy. People don't live here. They go to enough treatments outside, so it's often hard to do support groups here actually at the hospital. But I have a wonderful resource in the area, which is the Organ Transplant Support, which is an organization for transplant recipients and people waiting. And it's a patient-recipient-run organization, and they do education and support groups. So even though I've not on any consistent basis been able to do support groups for kidney recipients here at my hospital, we do have a lot of resources in the area. So matching people up with other resources has been helpful. And I know that there are transplant programs that have official mentoring, and we do have some programs here where we will match up somebody with somebody who's received a transplant, a potential recipient and a transplant, because it does help to talk to somebody who's walked the walk.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I'd like to add something to that. I'm Tamara Lewis, and I'm a motivational speaker and a kidney transplant recipient. And I'm going to be real blunt, because in my motivational sessions that I do, when I'm talking to either potential transplant patients, those who are possibly on dialysis and wanting to receive a kidney, these are the words that I say. Transplantation is not for wimps. If you have a problem on dialysis being in compliance, you will have a problem handling your transplant, point blank.
Right.
I mean, it's just that simple. Okay. So you got to get yourself in shape while you are on dialysis. Change your attitude and your whole emotional state of mind, because once you make the decision that you want the transplant, you have to get your mindset in a work mode, because that is what you're going to do.
I'd like to add to that too, Tamara. I think the social worker, especially in the pre-evaluation stage of a transplant, is in a unique position to ensure that that message comes across. And even then, you find many patients and their families ignoring a lot of what is said because there's so much information flowing at them. But at that point, both in your words as a social worker to them, I still recall, and of all the things that happened to me waiting for that heart transplant, there was a lot. I can recall the social worker's comment when she said, "Mr. Gleason, this is not a black and white decision. It's not a decision of life or death." And I was waiting for a heart transplant, so you'd think it was. She says, "This is a gray question. This is a question of quality of life, and there's no guarantee as to what your quality of life is going to be post-transplant." That hit me so that even 13 years later, that one sentence I can remember despite all the information that flowed at me. So I'm saying that you social workers are in a unique position to make sure they get that message. And you certainly have many willing transplant, post-transplant patients who are available to bring into that conversation or to put in touch with that patient so that they can truly understand what's involved. And I just want to emphasize your role in that, because you're the one place they come through where they can get that information straightforward.
This is Rachel. Can I also just add one little thing?
Please
that,
do. Take your time.
You know, one way to also look at it, you know, and to phrase it is also that it's really a continual growing process. You know, it, like Jim says, you know, it's a gray area. It's about quality of life and a new life that you might not know what it's going to be like. For me, you know, I meet a lot of people, and even nephrologists who work, who say, "I didn't know you were a kidney transplant recipient." And I always pat my kidney, who's down in my lower right pelvic region, and I say, "You know what? We're growing together." And it's very much on a physical level that, you know, here's this someone else's. It was a young girl's kidney that's with me, and we're very much growing together on a physical level. But it's also on a spiritual and emotional level, too. And I, you know, continually acknowledge that. And that's the way I perceive it, is that it's really a growing process that goes on forever. And some of us are more aware of it because we have had a transplant experience, but it's really true for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Once again, if you would like to ask a question or make a comment, please press star 1.
That's some good questions.
At this time, I show no questions.
Okay. If there's no more questions, I would like to thank the panel for their talks.
And I would like to thank all of you who have joined us today and hope that this will help you within your social work practice as you assist patients on their transplant journey. Thank you very much for joining us, and this call will be podcast and posted on the Council of Nephrology Social Work website under What's New by the end of the month.
Hey, Catherine, could we just end with one last word?
Absolutely.
And that is a thank you to all you social workers out there for the wonderful work you do. And I would remind you that your view of transplantation may be slightly off-center in the sense that the patients you typically deal with are those having problems. And much like people who write books, there's other people who write an interesting story. The majority of transplant patients probably don't come back and see you. And that's a good thing because they probably are doing really well. So don't ever misunderstand that because 100% of the people that you see are talking about an issue or a problem, that that's the norm. That's the norm for people to come back for social worker support. And I'll bet you there's another 80% out there who just went back to life. And in many cases, unless they're outgoing like Rachel and Tamara and myself, a lot of people in the community will never know that they ever had a transplant because it's not obvious in their afterlife after the transplant. So keep that in mind. It's an important distinction because I think in your work, you tend to see those that are fighting the challenges that are not unusual, but not everybody faces them. And
keep
just a word of hope for you.
Keep up the good work, social workers.
And thank you to everyone out there.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Thank you, Jim, and thank you, Lara and Tamara and Rachel. This will conclude our call.